The worst timing. Sorry, everybody. How are we doing, everyone? Welcome back to the channel. I'm Ron Swanson. We're here with Eric Eisenberger once again to delve into the world of the ATF agent, the life of if it ain't got violent crime in it, we ain't taking the job. And we're going to learn all about some of the most outlandish gentlemen and ladies and gentlemen that you've come up against, Eric. But it's great to see you again. Thank you so much for being here, mate. And how are you keeping this week?
Honor to be here, Ron. Thank you so much for the opportunity, and tell everybody, buckle up. It's going to be another edge of your seat day.
Hell yeah. Well, we're looking forward to it, Eric. And just remind everyone, just give us a wee recap of exactly who you are and what your career was, Eric.
Sure. I'm a retired ATF agent, retired about 7.5 years ago, which for the people on the other side of the pond, alcohol, tobacco, firearms, and explosives, and really the mega violent crime bureau in the States. And prior to that, I was a detective in Brooklyn, an investigator before that, uniformed officer in there also. And really, all of that state and local time running around New York City as a police officer, detective, that set me up for success. And the talent that I worked with shaped everything of the product that ultimately made it to ATF and then the task force leader. And just guys like these are just legend names in New York City, guys like Richie Fagan, Louis Savelli, many others, both NYPD detectives. And they took me under the wing and as a young guy, and they didn't have to pay me any attention. But who knows what talent development they saw, and they schooled me up to really understand the job, how to talk to people, how to sit people down, get them to tell you something that they don't want to tell you, and how to worm your way into the most violent segment of the criminal world and crush them. And they were experts at that. And they passed the knowledge on, and many others did also. And then I had the chance later in my career to do the same thing with younger agents and officers. So I really never had a job, Ron. I couldn't wait to get to work every day.
Yeah, awesome. Absolutely. Well, look, let's go through some of those violent gangs, violent criminals. Take us through one of your operations, Eric, if you can.
Sure. So I've always been really in ATF. If there's not a component of violence to an investigation, with some exception, why are you doing that investigation? We're only 2,200 agents worldwide, and you have to apply your resources to make the biggest impact against the worst people causing destruction in the community. So I was lucky to always be in that situation. And then when I was lucky enough to be selected to lead task forces in the United States, both in New York City, Kansas City, and what we're going to concentrate a little bit on, the Mexican border, no shortage of violence. These were just, if you look at who commits the most violent crime, if you took the criminal element, you could drill it down to about 1 or 2% of those that are probably doing at least 50% of the violent acts, the shootings, the murders, the pattern armed robbery crews, drug trafficking organizations, all of that. It's a very small segment, what we call the worst of the worst. And that was the mandate that our headquarters pushed out. It's like, these are the people that we're going after. 100 good targets, but these 5 are the absolute worst. That's what we're doing. And that was the entire career, really. And I couldn't believe I was getting paid to do that mission. It was like nirvana. But so I ran my first task force that I led was the New York City Joint Firearms Task Force Group 4. And that was focused on pattern armed robbery crews, firearms trafficking, and really the people that were causing the mayhem. And I did that for a bunch of years, moved on to run the Long Island Task Force. And when I was out there, our Special Operations Division in headquarters, I got a quick phone call from one of the bosses in DC, and they said, hey, we're standing up a 120-day detail on the Mexican border, basically out of San Diego, home invasion task force. Really, it was marketed as a violent crime task force, but everybody knew the focus was going to be on home invasion crews, just hardcore armed robbery crews that were looking to take down stash houses. Why pay for 10 kilos of white when I can just conduct an armed robbery, steal all of yours? And that was an identified problem. So in ATF, we don't front load, hey, this is the situation we want to go after. We examine what is the actual crime problem in an area, and are we an asset that can best address this particular problem? So we don't want to be everything to everybody, because then you're an inch thick, you're a mile wide, and you're nothing to everybody. So these home invasion task forces had been run, and they were specifically just a few months in duration, about 4 months. And there would be a lot of pre-workups done to get the local police departments on board with the techniques that we were going to be doing, get their assistance in doing the investigations, the operations. We coordinated with the United States Attorney's Office, the local prosecutors. So everybody that needed to know knew what we were going to do, how we were going to do it, and when we were going to do it. And everybody was on board. So the one that I was asked to be one of the two supervisors, leaders of, was in the summer of 2010. 2009, the task force just prior to that had been in Phoenix, Arizona, which at that time was called the kidnapping capital of the United States in relation to narcotics and home invasions. Home invasion crews, these violent armed gangs that would do an armed incursion into a residence during daylight hours, knowing that there are armed, multiple armed males inside this location to guard their supply. And these armed robbery crews raised their hand and they said, hey, that's a good idea. We'll knock that house down. And there was no shortage of those crews, both when they did it in Phoenix in 2009 and the one that I was involved with in 2010 down in San Diego. So to vanilla box it a little bit, selection of the personnel was paramount. You had to put the right people on the bus at the same time,
of course,
to accomplish what you wanted to do. So we had a component of deep undercover personnel. That's all they did in ATF. They would go around the country as situations presented themselves, and they would do long-term undercovers with a violent organization.
When we talk about these undercover agents, right? I mean, surely it take. I mean, obviously ATF agents are a special breed, right? But these deep undercover agents, I mean, that must be just a nightmare incarnate if you are not completely dialed in, right?
Well, correct. And as we say, not just ATF, but any organization that's doing the undercover piece, it's a volunteer sport. So you volunteered once to become an agent or a police officer. You volunteer again to go into the undercover world. And as in any other specialized area, there have been sidesteps, two steps forward, four steps back, a lot of hard lessons learned, a lot of shootings, a lot of good guys that lost their lives. And every situation going back decades, the unemotional examination, what happened, what went wrong, why did it go wrong, and how do we move forward with safety nets and techniques that put the survival points on our side of the table and not the bad guy's side. So it's a technique. It's almost like whiskey. You distill it, you learn your lesson, just distill it again until you wind up with a very, very methodical, well thought out operation to accomplish the goals that you want. And even doing all of that, there is still the wild card, as we've said before in the prior interviews, the bad guy always gets a vote. The bad guy will always determine how an arrest occurs. We present overwhelming force immediately, violence of action, and what's our goal? The bad guy surrenders peacefully. Nobody gets hurt. We don't get hurt. They don't get hurt. The public doesn't get hurt. However, sometimes bad guys say, I'm not going to jail today. And we may have a foot chase, a car chase, or at the worst end of the spectrum, a use of force case or a shooting situation. We are superbly prepared to execute any of those options. We don't want to do that. We want the peaceful surrender, but we're prepared for everything. And in my career, I've run into everything from the surrender to the chases to gunfights, gunplay. So
yeah, it's terrifying to think how the dynamics of your job, whether it's, I mean, how often did these gangs get the upper hand or turn someone that was undercover, or is that all just movie stuff?
Well, I've had good friends killed in undercover operations, and
it's
something that you really never get over. We say we never forget. We never forget, but we're not going to dwell on the bad thing. We're going to learn everything we can from what happened, make adjustments, and continue on. The mission always continues.
Now, when you were active, right, with the, because gangs and violent crime or organized crime seems to just be everywhere right now, or disorganized violent crime as well, because, you know, not all of these gangs and enterprises are as criminally savvy as the next. Do you see a different and shift in the tactics from when you were, you know, active and to how things are conducted now?
Yes. The violence is always in the air. It's always just out there or right in front of you. But what is our response, or how are we going to plan to most safely conduct an operation, being an undercover operation, an arrest operation, a search warrant operation? So the tactics have greatly improved and always improving. The equipment has always improved. The real state of the state for acts of violence from these crews has probably ratcheted up. They're availed of a lot of things that the good guys are availed to: quality weapons, vehicles, technology that's out there that we use, they use, that we all use every day. But really, the lack of value of human life. That mm-hmm. is really the wild card. And my opinion, that lack of value of human life has gotten worse. That more gangsters, there's no remorse, there's no regard for human life. And I'll tell you, I could do a white paper on it. I think the social media piece, the violent video games, the people that feel they're successful in the crime game that will get on Instagram. I mean, thank God they're stupid. We'd never catch any of them, but they flaunt themselves and their criminal leanings. They will take pictures of them and all their friends holding guns. They will take pictures of, look at all this money I made today. The clothes, the cars, the women. A young person sees that and they're like, I want that. I want the women. I want that money. I want to drive a new Mercedes. Well, how's that going to happen? How's it going to happen tomorrow? Because everything is like now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's conduct some armed robberies. Let's do this, do that. Criminal activities, and it's always the same. There's one thread that goes through every needle, and that is money. Mm-hmm. I want to put as much money in my hand right here, right now, as I possibly can, and then I'm gonna spend it just as fast as I got it. And that's another pattern that we've seen over and over again. I remember one particular gun deal we did in Brooklyn mm-hmm. with an undercover, and it was probably over 25 guns were part of this transaction. And that was a lot of money. It was probably $20,000 that exchanged hands in a parking lot. And we then followed the crew of bad guys, probably six or seven of them. Where did they go? Immediately to a downtown shopping area in Brooklyn, and we watched them. They bought clothes. They bought gold grills for their teeth. They probably whizzed through that 20,000 in 24 hours. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, Ron, I would sit down with these bad guys, and I'm like, did you ever think of taking 100,000 and buying a house? You know, when I drive through the bad area and I see the Range Rover parked on the street,
right?
That, you know, it's we're not profiling. That's
a bit of a giveaway, right?
Yeah, you're advertising. You know, you are telling me everything by showing me everything, and you know, it's a sad state of affairs. You can show the way to the youngsters, but they always have in their face that status of these real gangsters, armed robbers, drug trafficking organizations that flaunted on social media. And these youngsters mm-hmm. that have leanings towards that life to begin with, they're like, that's it. That's what I want to do.
That was going to be my next question, because whether it's entertainment, whether it's music, whatever, there is this huge online prevalence of gang lifestyle. I mean, there always has been in rap and music and things like this, there has been that projection of that lifestyle. But it seems now that it is just organized crime groups that are flaunting on social media. Has that added to the problem, but also assisted in taking these morons out by any chance, or taking them down?
Yeah, it if you know how to look and where to look, it enhances what we do. And as an example, when I was in Kansas City, there was a prevalent crew doing home invasions, running a drug trafficking organization, selling firearms, selling explosives. I mean, they had their hands in everything. They also had a music label. They had a recording studio. They had everything. And the videos, their original music videos that they put out were professionally produced endeavors. You would look at these videos and you would think, my God, this must have been done in like Universal Studios. That's how good it was. But we knew a little bit more about them than they thought. So when we're watching some of these videos, we were able to show that some of these videos were the actual reenactments of actual robberies, shootings, and murders that they had conducted in real life. It's not fun unless you can tell 10 of your friends all about it. And at the end, when we took that crew down, the avalanche of evidence that we were able to put on the table. There were only two people that went to trial and they both lost, and they're both going to die in prison. And that was over a murder that they committed. And they had committed it at a rap event, at an actual venue where all these different groups showed up and everybody is, you know, trash talking these other groups. Well, in my world, when we trash talk some other group, it's all in fun. It's in jest. But these crews, not fun. And nothing seemingly can go to a fist fight. Everything has got to be solved with the gun. And they chose to solve a little dispute with a rival with a gun. And now they're eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for the rest of their life.
Right. Yeah, we've got a similar situation. Starman had mentioned it here with the UK drill scene, which is, again, this is the sort of post you're getting over here, right?
Yep.
You know, and I'm sure it's the same over the pond. So what would you say, Eric, is one of the most memorable moments of your career with regards to operations or the size of the bust? What's the one that is the crown jewel in your memories?
Yeah, God, where would I start? I got a bucket of like 100 of those. But for the gentle listeners, a sort of rough little outline of where we're going to go. I'm going to start out, and you're going to love this. Some just stories about the home invasion task force that we had down on the Mexican border.
Oh, yeah.
And then segue that to the last shooting that I was involved in before I retired with my squad out in Kansas City. And you'll see the contrast of two different types of criminal element, yet the lack of value of human life.
Oh, yeah, the brutality.
It was the common thread and the pursuit of money and narcotics. So the adventure down in San Diego that I was the luckiest phone call I ever got was, hey, would you be interested in being one of the two supervisors on this effort? And I couldn't say yes fast enough. I had heard about these type of operations that we had going on around the country and just applauded the just pinpoint parachuting in of the talent pool on our side to address the problem. And I was like, if I ever get a chance to, you know, help this effort, I'm in, all in. So when I got the phone call, that was like, yes, I'm in. And then I had to make a quick phone call to my bride and say, hey, I'm going to disappear for like 120 days. I know, please. And she's like, yeah, go be all you can be. And that's okay. The other thing, Ron, it doesn't matter. Law enforcement, your world, my world, anybody that's listening. If you don't have your other half supporting your action, that is a tough road find any happiness, because you're always going to have it in the back of your mind. I've got this steady stream of negativity coming from my other half. Like, where are you? What are you doing? I don't even know where you are half the time. Or you have the supportive other half that's like, hey, you're all in. I understand the mission. You want to be a part of it. Go be all you can be. And that's what I had. And similarly, all the guys that I worked with had that other half. It's kind of a secret sauce ingredient. If you don't have that, you're already waking up. Your head comes off the pillow. 30% of your energy is already, you know, zapped out of you for the day. But so this was in 2010. And it was an assembly of just the best of the best of the ATF, the undercover pool that was used, the case agents that were used, the local detectives that came on board to help the uniformed officers that helped us out at the takedown operations, our special response team that would come in on every single takedown that we had, every single operation. We had a special response team element that was full-time with us everywhere we went, everything we did, every deal, every surveillance, everything. So ATF saw the value in it, thank God, and they never balked at the expense. It probably runs at least $1 million to run one of these 120-day details. When you think, and everything has got to be pretty much cash, because you, as we say, you don't want to leave pecker prints coming back to the United States government. So you're not going to use the U.S. government credit card. You're not, everything is cash. So when we're renting, where are your undercovers going to stay? You're probably not going to stick them in the Marriott. That doesn't make sense. That doesn't make sense for what they're saying. So we found unbelievable housing 20 feet from the beach in Southern California, in San Diego. And we would rent these multi-floor, multi-apartment houses right on the beach and put our personnel in there. So nobody knew who they were. Nobody knew what they were. And they could come and go in just complete anonymity. Awesome. Myself and the other supervisor, the government says, well, we don't need to do that for you, but we're going to stick you in just prepaid apartment housing in one of these like Melrose Place type condo complexes. Again, you guys, you're nobody. You come and go. You're like anybody else that lives there. So it just, the whole setup worked out phenomenal. And you had to get a ton of rental cars. So we were getting rental cars from regular rental places, but then we needed to identify, we wanted to be like off the grid, if you will. So we found shady places that, yeah, they weren't Avis or Hertz, but they had rental cars and it was cash and carry. And we did that. So anybody running these plates or the vehicle identification number or anything having to do with that car came back to nothing. It came back to like a rabbit hole of, you know, not us, not the United States government.
So
that was good. And then we had to have sort of a home base operation. We had to have a location that we could operate out of, again, that nobody would really know who you are. So we were able to find outside the city of San Diego, more actually closer to the actual border, an industrial park, businesses, and we rented a few floors of a building, and we could operate the case people, our technical operation. We had an entire floor dedicated to technical operations, and we flew in our own tech people. So there is so much hachi-dachi electronic gizmos and gadgets.
Oh, hell yeah. Tell me all about them, Eric. How many did you, manage to sneak out the back door? Okay. How many did you get?
What was the extent of the tech? It's just because you mentioned it. What was the extent of the tech?
The what?
What was the true extent of the technology that you guys had access to? Was it all surveillance stuff, things like that?
So a lot of surveillance equipment, and this is 2010, so 16 years later, literally the stuff that we thought was cutting edge back then, we would look at that today and go, this is like ancient. If you look at the curve of technology development that brought us the smartphones, which then into AI and the internet and just every leap and bound advance, and it's almost faster than you can keep up with it. So you could buy cutting edge stuff today. In 6 months, there's going to be something even better. So, but the stuff we had for then, it was the best of the best. And we had two full-time tech guys assigned to us, to the operation. So not only did they manage the gear, but there were so many times where they had to invent gear. They like, hey, we have this kind of situation and we need this. Oh, I can make that. And they did. Mm-hmm. And unbelievable. So it's not only just having like stuff off the shelf, but it's the ability to say, hey, we need this, and it's not off the shelf. And you get two of these geniuses that say, oh, I can make that. You tell me what you need this thing to do, and we'll make it happen. And they did. They were literal just experts, masters of the craft. And you couldn't stump them. Like we never got the answer. I can't do that. I don't know how to do that. I don't think we can figure that out. Never ever did they say that. They were like, they were make it happen. They were rainmakers. And we were, so every little component of this 120-day operation, it was really the best of the best that ATF and the local agencies had rolled into one operation, marching together in a direction. And I tell you what, it was formidable. We absolutely crushed. People say, well, you can't get everybody. Yeah, but we got you. And now you're chained to the wall forever. But there were, we've never lost a case, by the way, with the way that we did it. Because the first thing that people, the haters want to say is you're entrapping people. In other words, entrapment is getting somebody that, except for involvement with a government agent or informant, I never would have done something like that. Well, the way that you destroy that defense and the way we destroyed every single one, we've never lost a case and we've never lost an appeal because the technique is that bulletproof. So early on, when we started dealing with these armed robbery crew gangsters from both Mexico and from the United States, we had a way of getting in front of them. And if you could imagine an actor getting an audition for a movie part, that's the position that we were able to put these bad guys into. They were almost auditioning to be an armed robbery crew at the behest or to take advantage of a situation that we're laying out. Like, I'm involved in a drug trafficking organization, and I know about every time I do something for them, there's multiple kilos of the white, there's armed gunmen protecting this private house. So the technique has distilled itself down to the bad guys audition for this part. When we've identified one of these crews, we we look into them before we ever deal with them. Who are they? And typically, they're multi-convicted violent felons. They've already been convicted of armed robbery in the state, but they've never really tasted prison time because just the way that the criminal justice system is in a lot of big cities on, you know, the lower level when you're dealing with state arrests. Federally, it's a 180. You get bagged federally. That's because you actually have raised your hand a few times. Like, hey, look at me. Look what I'm willing to do. And we put you in federal prison forever at where you belong. You're not going to victimize anybody else. But we had the ability to almost, in essence, give the bad guy a stage, a microphone, and they would lay out for us. We would tell them nothing. We would suggest nothing. We merely would say, we know about the way that this stash operation works, and there's an opportunity to conduct an armed robbery at one of these locations. And they would say, this is what we do. Well, tell me how you would do this. How do you usually do this? And they would go, oh, easy. And they would literally act out, because now we're videoing and audio recording this. They have no idea. They would have no idea if they spent an hour looking around trying to find our gear. They wouldn't. But they would lay out in excruciating detail, oh, here's how we do these. This is what we do. And so you cannot raise the entrapment defense. You're what we call predisposed to commit this crime. You're telling us that you've done this several times in the past. We've looked at your record. You have violent crime convictions, either armed robbery offenses, firearms-related crimes, drug-related crimes. So you're not Snow White. You're in the game. And we are giving you an admission ticket to just see how much in the game you're willing to be. And they cannot... In other words, it's not pulling teeth on our end. These bad guys couldn't wait to unburden themselves of how they do these armed robberies, how they're going to do this armed robbery. And we would always, almost every time, we would learn through other methods that on game day, the robbery day, when they were going to knock this house down, they were planning on killing our undercover. They didn't know he was an undercover. They just said, well, he's another cog in the wheel. Why split this five ways when we could just split it four ways? And they had always laid out the plan. Well, we're going to kill him too. So these are, again, what we talked about before.
Yeah.
No value to human life. It's pursuit of money.
Eric, we've seen, like, with the Mexican cartels, this elevation of brutality, the public displaying of brutality, and this next level in control through fear within their own ranks, right? I mean, that's obviously something that's very prevalent with the Mexican cartels. How prevalent was that within the gangs that you were with, and how different is it now? Because it seems, I mean, skinning a bunch of people and hanging them off bridges seems a bit excessive to me, Eric. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so I did not run across that particular level of savagery. However, there have been torture sessions in these armed robberies, home invasions in the United States. Armed robbery crew is inside the house with the bad guy and his family, and bad guy doesn't want to give it up. And one guy got tied to a chair. They took a power drill. They drilled through his ankles. They committed essays on the wife and daughters in front of this tied up dad. And you're gonna give it up now?
I mean, like, what's the crack? If you give up, they're just going to kill you, right? I mean, is he stalling? Like, what do you think goes through the mind of somebody who has had their ankles drilled out and witnessed this and still hasn't given up the goods? I mean, is it a case of they don't have the goods and they've got, like, I don't know, like, I mean, it just seems wild. Or is it just the love of the money?
You know, it's dedication to their craft, not our craft. And it's, you know, there's nothing random about the home invasion thing. They are there for a reason. They're not breaking into the household. You know, they've got the information. They've corroborated, you know, done their homework.
Are you saying that in their world, if you've gone through something like that, not given up any of the product and gotten away from it, you're seen as somebody who gets elevated because you've allowed your wife and daughter and ankles to suffer over the business? Does that make sense?
It doesn't make sense to you or me.
No. I've explained it right, yeah. That's a thing. That's an actual thing. Wow.
Yeah, it's going through their head. Is he really going to kill me? Is he really going to kill my family? Well, in enough cases, yes. And I'll give you an analogy that will literally starkly explain it. So with the terrorism that's going on, primarily the Middle East, if you take Hamas, ISIS, mm-hmm. Al-Qaeda, their motivation is an ideology. The violence is all in pursuit of their ideology, their fanaticism.
Yes.
The cartels, on the other hand, drug trafficking organizations, their motivation is money, not an ideology. Not
money and fear. Depends which part of the pyramid you're on, right? Like, I mean, it all comes back to the money, right? But the more.
Yeah. So which one makes it easier to kill people, torture people? That's a crapshoot. But it is out of control violence south of the border. And many have made the argument that Mexico is a failed nation state. In other words, it's a narco state. It has a government. It has a president. The country of Mexico is divided into several states with their own government structure, police departments. But the money has so wormed its way into government, law enforcement, the military, that you can almost not have a pure unit that is going to do the right thing and want to crush these bad guys, because the bad guys have unlimited supplies of money. And in large part, because there is such a demand in the United States and other Western nations for the narcotic product that drives the profits.
Yeah. I mean, I spoke to an active cartel member, I think a week ago, on the podcast, and that's what they were talking about, was it's establishing pipelines. It's about getting trying to get the product from Mexico into the US. Mad conversation, Eric. Like, it really is.
Yeah.
Like, I spoke to a guy called TJ Dominguez a few days ago, and that was Escobar's pilot, like his main smuggler. And all I'm thinking is, I need to get Eric on a panel show with these people. Like, we just need to see how the three minds would collide. But the cartels are, it's just a different world, man. Like, when you said it was like a failed country or a failed state, you feel like somebody behind a desk somewhere has allowed this to happen in Mexico. That's what it feels like. And whether that's through someone having their ankles drilled up or a fat sack of money, it feels like it's a perpetual cycle of that mindset. It really is.
A lot of these government law enforcement officials get a fork in the road choice by the any one of the several cartels. This is the choice. You can take the silver, or you can get the lead.
Right.
Which do you want? And we've been fortunate in ATF that we've been able to identify units that are unpolluted and still, you know, they want to do the right thing for their people, their country, and they will assist with a pure heart the efforts that we're bringing to the table to help them rid their areas of the bad man. But when you have the dump truck of money, or you're going to get killed, which do you want? Because they are that prevalent in society. And again, it goes back to the youngest parts of these organizations. What do they see? The women, the cars, the clothes, the guns, the lifestyle, the power. In their minds, they think it's power. It's really temporary power because nobody really goes the distance in that game. The graveyard or prison. You're not going to die of old age.
I mean, here's another thing, Eric, right? I think for most of us, especially when we think about the American gangs, we're taking it from a mindset of they're throwing their life away. They had all the opportunities. All they had to do was, you know, buckle down and work. When we talk about Mexico and other areas of the world where, like, life is a lot cheaper, right? Things are not the way they are here. Do you think that the economic factor of a lot of these places is the driving factor for the criminality, and especially with people that are coming up into it now?
Yeah, there's no doubt of that. And there's one thing about the United States, and that is the self-reliance. You're in charge of your destiny. You can be anything that you want to be. It's like the harder you work, the more success that you can come across. So there, to the vast majority of people in America and Canada and you know all the Western nations of the world, the harder you work, the better you can do, the better situation for you, better situation for your family, your kids, their kids. You're setting every generation up for success. And there's this drive to do that legally. So after my government service, literally the next day, I started my first business. And now I've opened up a second business. And it is all channeled to increase success for the family, and it's all hard work and legal, and there's not a brushing thought of, wow, I could get there so much faster if I would just do this. I am not even going to consider it, think about it. The thought of the illegal road, it's just anathema to me and to all of my friends and peers and everybody that I've worked with and my collection of, you know, everybody in my life. We're not going to do that. We're going to do this. It's the right thing to do. And Ron, there's another common thread within people that I worked with through 30 plus years, a religious component. And a religious component of, we believe in the good of people. We believe in helping people that want to be helped. And the basic foundation is we are not going to do something bad to anybody for any reason. We're just not going to do it. And we're not going to tolerate anybody doing it to people if we have the ability to stop it. Mm-hmm. It's a strong belief system in something like that, I think, is extremely helpful for the line of work that I was in. And again, personally speaking, I, of course, believe in the resurrection and heaven and God and Jesus and everything. Everybody's got a court date. When you end life on earth, there's a court date. You're going to stand tall before the man and you're going to answer for what you've done. You've been given a life. You've been given an opportunity, many opportunities. What'd you do with that? Did you hurt people? Did you, again, have no value of human life? I've put you on this earth to do good, and you didn't, and you hurt people. I think there you got to answer for that. We're here for a short amount of time.
I agree. I mean, it's different religions, different gods, but same mindset. Do you know what I'm saying? And you know, I've asked the viewers to send in some questions, which we're going to get into in a minute, Eric.
Because, sure.
I think the way that you talk, honestly, the way that you talk about your career, right? In my head, when you're talking, I'm just playing it out like an action movie, right? Because it was during this, like, and I often say this, is there was a golden era, right? Like, for example, I talk about the golden era of like the serial killers where there was no CCTV. Do you know what I'm saying? Where somebody could literally be nabbed two doors down from you, be in a basement six doors down, and no one would know where anyone was. People didn't used to lock their doors. This era for you seems like there was the era of the badass cop, right? Because it seems like everything now with police and operations and the way that you have to go in is so much more geared towards not upsetting the criminals. And it feels like that. Do you often feel like there's like a pair of gloves that have been put on the police force in the modern age?
It's, Ron, it makes me want to cry. And all my peers that are retired or at the end of their career, and we reflect back to the way it was in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so what's one common factor in the beginning of all our careers? There was no social media. There was no internet. There's no Google. There weren't cell phones. Mm-hmm. There weren't even pagers when I started. So...
Well, those were dial phones, though, right, Eric? The 2, the 3. Yeah, we're going back to the day, right? I was there.
Show that to my kids, and they're like, what the heck is that?
I remember those phones, too, bro.
Yeah, it's so you look at events,
yep,
and you look at these seismic shifts in perspective of how people want to look at them. So one seismic shift in the United States was in the summer of 2020. We had the George Floyd incident, and it seemed like an excuse for just unbridled mayhem, riots, killings, shootings.
I tell you what, though, they kept the backstory about that gentleman out of the news for a long time. It was very...
Yeah, you know, I will... Yeah, so I've heard all of that stuff, but I had a... Not just me, but all the guys that I worked with and gals in these task forces, mm-hmm. we had a value of human life.
Of course.
So I had a sort of... here is my standard of conduct. And not just for me, but for everybody that I led. How do we treat prisoners? How do we treat suspects? How do we conduct ourselves? And I always said, this is how you will never make a mistake. How do you treat a prisoner? You treat that prisoner the way you would want your little brother treated, or your son or daughter. How would you want them treated if they were the ones in handcuffs? And if you do that, you really can't, you're not going to have a bad outcome with that. Now, when you're trying to arrest somebody, remember, bad guy gets a vote, you're trying to arrest somebody and they don't want to be arrested, that never, ever, ever looks pretty to the people outside our world.
Eric, I'm not going to lie, I cannot get enough of the police body cam footage. Right, bro? Like, yeah. I grew up with cops, right?
Yeah, we all did. Yeah.
We're lucky enough to have a friend who had Sky and you could watch cops. Oh, the early 90s, man, it was like, it was incredible. And you know, it was back, everything just looked different back then. The cop cars, their wee hats, everything was just different, right? And this body cam footage now, I think the number one thing that police are getting taught is patience, because I'm telling you now, some of these police have the patience of a saint, okay?
Yeah. You know, so a good way to think about it, so how does a police officer and a member of law enforcement conduct yourself? You want an outcome with somebody. You want to stop a bad thing from happening, or you're investigating a bad thing or a bad person. It's a very simple concept. How do you conduct yourself? We ask somebody what we want to do, a lawful command, ask. They don't want to comply. Then we tell them, you're now being told. And if we have no luck with one and two, the third option is make them. So you ask, you tell, and then you make. And it's the make part that is almost the speed bump where a lot of younger law enforcement, they've seen the outcome of all these cops that have gotten into trouble because people think they were too heavy-handed or their use of force was unreasonable. So now these cops are self-restrained from doing the obvious thing that needs to be done. And ask, tell, make. And they don't want to do the make part. And then the situation just escalates. So when you have a bad guy that realizes this officer is not going to engage me, fearful to engage me, my conduct is now going to become more outrageous, a massive danger to the officer, mm-hmm. to the public, to everything. When I see the videos of, and I'll just keep it for New York City, and this was like two summers ago, uniformed cops getting buckets of water thrown on them, and everybody's got the phone out, everybody's recording it, and the cops. Well,
in Scotland, a friend of mine, right, this, it was an adult, it was a 16-year-old man, right? Boy, right, it was a boy. But he was like throwing stones at my mate's shop, and he went out and threw a bucket of water over these kids, right? There were 16, they were sitting in that's an adult in my country. And he was charged with assault, right? So I'm just saying that the New York cops have had it tight, bro. Like they have had it tight since Insano, whatever his name is, took over New York. It is bananas.
It is. However, if you don't have a rash reaction, but you have a measured, smart, you're in charge of the situation response, you know, the ask, tell, make. When you go through the ladder of now we're talking to now I'm going to detain you to I'm going to actually arrest you. When you let the bad guy know through your voice, your command presence, your actions, everything about the way you present yourself that, hey, wrong cop. That nonsense that you see all your friends do, wrong guy to do that with.
The cops, yeah. though, surely they've been told that if you're getting buckets of water thrown at you and people are laughing at you and filming you for social media and you react to it, you're fired. That is the only way I can like get into my, because it's not an easy process. There's like paperwork and you have to like run and stuff, like getting into the cop, like being a policeman. It's not just like you fill in a form and join up like McDonald's, right? So there is that in the back of your mind of, you know, I've worked to be here. And if I've got to behave this way to stay here, some people are going to jump to that. Is that what we're looking at here?
Well, I think there's another side to the coin, Ron. If the officer, let's just say the bucket of water thrown on him, and these are not 12-year-old kids throwing the water. These are adult males, gangsters. Like, look what we can do because we know these cops are going to do nothing because
It would be Taze Town, bro. It would be Taze Town if that was me. Do you know what I mean?
You throw a bucket of water on me. I'm a uniformed police officer. I'm investigating something. I'm here to disperse a crowd. Whatever the case is, and you're going to throw water on me, at the very least, that's an arrestable offense for disorderly conduct and probably a few other things too. So now I've got a legal basis that I am now going to have a legal intervention with you. I'm going to stop you. I'm going to talk to you. I'm going to arrest you. Hey, get on the ground. You're under arrest. They don't want to get on the ground. They've had a lawful command. Now we move to the next level. Now I have to make you do the lawful command that I've given you. And I think the other side of the coin, Ron, is that when the 400 cell phones recording that little encounter see that there's a consequence to doing that
ridiculous
act. And then now we're in a situation where we're placing you in custody. And you decide that, because you get a vote, you don't want to be placed in custody. You do not want to comply with lawful orders or a lawful arrest, and you're going to resist arrest because the law says you cannot do that. We fight things in court, not in the street. Well, now you're going to get the reasonable amount of force applied to effect that arrest. If you just want to be non-compliant, like you're not going to arrest me, you're not going to arrest me, you're going to get help to the ground, you're going to be arrested. Or if you go to the other extreme that you want to actively fight that officer, and within 2 seconds, you are slammed to the ground. Now you're injured, and now you're going to get use of force techniques to ensure your compliance with the lawful order. All those camera videos may serve as notice to every other idiot. Well, don't be that guy, because this is what's going to happen. And quite frankly, if a good, solid officer knows the law, the way to speak to people, the way to gain compliance just by your presence, mm-hmm. and the way you talk to people and the way you respect people, I always gave everybody maximum respect, whether they deserved it or not. And it went a long way. But you know the law, you know the case law, you had to develop reasonable suspicion, probable cause, an arrestable offense. You followed everything in the patrol guide of how to conduct yourself. And now we have a situation where you're correctly using reasonable amount of force. I think if there would be more videos of that, and then people saying,
do you know what the problem is? There is. There's, the internet is full of awesome experiences with policemen all over the world. Mm-hmm. They just don't make headlines. Do you know what I'm saying? This is I want to lead on to this next question for you, Eric, because the George Floyd case, and we've had cases in the UK where the individuals at the center of the case, the way the media reports on them, right? It almost seems like what they're trying to do is create public division by not giving over the full story. Have you found that the media can really affect how the boys are seen effectively? Because it seems to just be, it's the bad news that sells, really.
The days of Walter Cronkite are over, where it would be a unemotional delivery of an event without having an influence of an agenda. It's just the way it is. The mainstream news outlets in the United States, NBC, ABC, CNN, they have a very liberal ideology. And I think the majority of them are all good people. They're good Americans. They want to report an event. But when they bring an ideology to a news event, that you're not giving me the news, you're giving me your version of what you think happened. Just tell me what happened. I don't want report on an event and let good people sort it out. Mm-hmm. Don't give me your take on it, your slant on it, your
right. Report the truth, man. Report the truth, and
quite frankly, the good vast majority of law enforcement in the United States not only are not going to do bad things, they're not going to allow bad things to happen. And with the George Floyd thing, so there's George Floyd on the ground. You got Chauvin, the cop that's leaning on this guy's neck area. And then you got two other officers. Well, one of those officers, it's just right out of the academy. It's like this guy doesn't even know how to tie his shoes or order lunch yet.
Eric, when it comes to Floyd and the guy that sat on his neck, right? I'll be honest with you. If this had happened in Scotland, a member of the public would have dealt with that police officer straight up. But we don't have guns. They don't have guns here. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, there were a number of people that were chiming in from the sidewalk.
No. Yeah. Listen, if the guy's in handcuffs and on the floor, you don't need to be cutting off. It seemed unnecessary. But
it was as wrong could be. That is right? Not the way anybody. I
mean, if the guy's not in handcuffs, right, or there's like a big massive kerfuffle going on, sure, hold the guy down, right? I mean, if you're having trouble breathing, stop resisting, sort of thing. But when he's lying face down like that and he's handcuffed, the whole case, the whole situation, the whole nightmare of that was so avoidable. And it really, if it wasn't for the fact that American police have got pistols, somebody from the public would have done something. I'm telling you now.
And many times the officers with the pistols in uniform have been attacked by crowds, and not because they were doing something wrong. It's because they, you know, somebody in the crowd wanted to get their buddy out of the situation. The thing is,
that's different, but yeah, I get what you're saying. It's
the golden rule is, how do we treat people? And quite frankly, police officers, it doesn't matter, United States, Europe, anywhere in the world, we have the most power of anybody on the face of the earth. And everybody would think, oh, well, you have the power to take a life. You have guns. You could shoot somebody. That's not the power. The most unbelievable power that a member of law enforcement has is the ability to take somebody's freedom. That is by far the greatest power that law enforcement has. We can take your freedom away from you. We're going to put you in jail. We're going to put you in prison. And you are cut off from everything that you know about life. That power has such a responsibility attached to it. Again, how do we treat people the way you would want your little brother treated, the way you would want your kid treated? And quite frankly, when somebody's in handcuffs, it's over. The fight is over. It's like that guy wanted to be a tough guy. The time to be a tough guy is before the handcuffs go on.
Right, exactly.
Don't tell me to take these handcuffs off. I could beat you. Just take these cuffs. Hey, pal, the cuff's already on. You had your opportunity, and I'm not taking that bait. I'm a professional. Yeah.
No, I'm with you.
And I'm conducting myself as such. I have had more success with violent people calmly explaining to them, you're under arrest. How you react to that is up to you. I would much rather treat you like a gentleman. I won't cuff you in front of your kids, but you're under arrest. I would rather bring you back to my office. We're going to sit down. I'm going to buy you a slice of pizza. I'm going to buy you a Happy Meal, and we'll figure it out. I will give you the opportunity to tell me anything you want to tell me, like gentlemen, but you are under arrest.
Hell yeah.
And yeah. I have had the toughest, you know, most, you know, violent prone people that are not used to that. They're not used to that in their own family, getting respect or respect from their peers. And here I am, the law enforcement guy, the guy that they assume is going to be the heavy-handed guy. I am the guy that presents, this is the way it is, and I want to treat you like a gentleman, but you get a vote. I'd rather you be a gentleman. I'll sit you down, we'll have a pizza, it'll be great. But you're going. And 99% of the people, they respond to that. They're not happy about it, but do you really want to have a wrestling match? Because you're going to lose. You see those 10 guys? They're my friends, not your friends. You will not win this. period. And especially as a federal agent, the case was done. Mm-hmm. Like, done. Before you ever saw me, before you saw the handcuffs, before I came to the house.
Right.
It's not, we're not trying to figure this out in right. the moment. It's been figured out.
Yeah, the ETF aren't there for a hunch. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. Well, look, we've got a couple of questions, Eric, that I went through with you from the crowd, yeah. right? This would be very much if I was a law enforcement officer, right? It's all about bribes, right? And those dirty cops, right? What happens when you find a fellow officer who's taking bribes? Has that ever happened to you?
They get arrested and they go to prison. There's no third direction.
You've got to rob the criminals. Don't take bribes. Just take all their product and their money. Okay. That's not legal advice. But yeah, no, carry on, Eric.
There is, so again, 99.99% of criminals are not going to die of old age. They're not going to go undetected. They're not going to live life off all the dump truck of money undetected. That's not reality. A police officer, a member of law enforcement that decides I'm going to take a bribe to not do my duty. There's nothing a good cop hates more than a bad cop.
Oh, he's a criminal. He's not there to be a cop. Trust me. I wouldn't be there to be a cop. I would be there to rob a bunch of criminals and just basically be a criminal with a badge.
And I've run across that, I think the prior story, you know, we told about the day yeah. I was in a shooting 30 years ago was two cops that were stealing kilos of the white and money. And they got arrested and they were held accountable for that.
Kilos of the white is mad, by the way. I just want to point that out. Like, I just have visions of this cop coming out of an evidence room with this thing under his jacket. Like,
it is virtually impossible to go undetected,
right?
There are so many redundant things
Feel
to
safe.
Prevent theft, especially of evidence that is so tightly controlled,
yeah.
and to take money, it's just not going to happen. ATF has a set of general orders, and every new agent when they're hired got to memorize them. You got to internalize them. General order number one: you will not lie, cheat, or steal, and you will not tolerate anybody that lies, cheats, or steals. You could be the person that just merely knows somebody did that and mm-hmm. you don't say anything. You're going to get treated as harshly as that guy's going to get treated. We are not going to tolerate that. So when I was still in, there was a search warrant done of a drug house and a freshly hired ATF agent's house, everybody else. And another agent sees him taking money and stuffing it down his pants. And he's like, well, that's not the way we treat money at a search warrant at all. Goes into an evidence bag. So he gets confronted in the front yard and confronted by the ATF boss running the operation and the person that saw that. And they said, hey, I saw you put money in your pants. Explain that. Well, he had about 40,000 jammed down his pants, and there is no explanation for that. And he was put in handcuffs in the front yard. The money was taken out of his pants and he was arrested. He was federally prosecuted and he went to prison. And goodbye career, goodbye everything. Was that worth it? Probably not at all. And everybody I worked with, it wasn't even something that needed to be discussed or thought about. It's just like, we're not doing that. And we're not letting anybody else do that either. The byproduct of being able to work in elite units, everybody's
100%. Right-minded. I'd never make it off a freaking beat cop, bro. Like, I would be way 100%.
There's no getting away with that stuff. You may successfully do that once, twice, three times, but it will not escape detection. Somebody's going to know about it. Somebody's going to talk about it. And then it's over. Fini. Goodbye pension. Goodbye your good name. Freedom. Goodbye everything.
Goodbye everything. Yeah, for sure. 100%. Yeah. Next question we've got. Okay. Is there a difference between your professional and personal opinions on the Second Amendment?
Not really. No. Okay. The Second Amendment is the Second Amendment for a reason. It was literally the most important thing behind freedom of speech. And I do not derive my rights from the government. I derive my rights from God, the pursuit of happiness and peace. The words crafted by our founders 250 years ago, they're as true today as they were then, and 1,000 years from now, they'll still be true. Mm-hmm. The Second Amendment is one of those things that separates the American society from many other Western countries, where the American citizen has the right to possess a firearm unless you've been these prohibitors, unless you're a drug addict, you're convicted of a felony, there's these prohibitors that you cannot legally possess firearm or ammunition. And those are all good. Everybody recognizes that is that's reasonable. However, okay. The right of somebody to possess a firearm for whatever the reason, to protect themselves and their family, that is not to be infringed. Now, many of the larger cities have tried to enact laws that just absolutely makes it near impossible for a non-prohibited, good citizen, productive member of society to be in possession of a handgun. And those statutes have been struck down one after the other, where the Second Amendment is, and it's an actual thing. So professionally and personally, I own a lot of guns, a lot. Nice. Every agent I know probably has even more than I do. And all my friends, non-law enforcement, similar position. We are avid outdoors people, avid hunters. We love the shooting sport. But I also love the idea that in the worst scenario possible, I have the ability to prevent harm to myself and, more importantly, my friends or family or whoever I'm with, or in my house, on my property. And in the state of Missouri where I live, there are relatively no gun laws. If you are over 21, not prohibited, you can possess 100 pistols, 1,000 pistols, rifles, whatever, firearms. It's really the Wild West still, but that's just the way it is. So in Missouri, if somebody wants to break into somebody's house or any other untoward act, a carjacking or some other violent crime, armed robbery, there's better than a 50-50 chance that potential victim is armed. And that sends a bit of a message. Like, if you really want to do the bad thing, you're most likely going to be confronting an armed citizen. Not good. The worldwide news, the shooting at In-N-Out Burger a few days ago.
Yeah, it's wild.
Two or three times. That incident was stopped by an off-duty police officer and an armed citizen that put effective fire on the bad guy. He realized, uh-oh, I'm shot. I'm not getting away. I've just committed this violent act. I've shot and killed people, and he killed himself. His vote is I'm not going to go to prison. So people looking to do the bad thing, you have to consider everybody I'm looking at is potentially armed. Mm-hmm. Is that a good idea? No. But if you go to countries that have nobody can be armed except the police, then you have a situation where I can victimize pretty much anybody I want.
Because what about a country where you're not armed and the police aren't armed? It's just the criminals, bro.
Yeah, it's just
that noise that you made explains all of it.
The fabric of our country here is the fabric of self-reliance, self-determination. I choose my own destiny for good or for bad. Mm-hmm. But as a good guy, I am afforded the means and opportunity, firearm ownership and possession, to defend my life of my family. And you just wish it was that way for everybody, for every country. And just look at Iran. So a bunch of protests in the street in January and February of this year. The estimates are all over the place, but 40,000 protesters were gunned down, murdered by the IRGC in the streets of Tehran because the local population is forbidden to have a firearm, period. The military has it. The police have it. That's it. So if you want to vote that you're going to duke it out with that, what are you going to do? Throw a rock? Throw a stick? Have a bow and arrow? Not good. That's an example of, and really the Second Amendment, you go through all the writings, it was to guarantee that the citizenry will not be the victim of a tyrannical government. And the tyrannical government back in the 1770s was England, and we, the colonists, were the local population that all had firearms. They were all hunters, farmers. But if it was not for that, what are we going to do when the redcoats decided, hey, we're blockading New York City, we're going to start mowing you people down? No way to defend, except we did have a way to defend. And very much that's why freedom of speech was the most important thing. That's why they made it the First Amendment, followed closely by the Second Amendment. Mm. And I can tell you, every ATF agent, we're the primary, our primary jurisdiction is enforcement of the federal firearms and explosive laws. We looked at it in the same light. We are not after the working man, the productive member of society, the good citizen that's armed or has guns in his house. We're after the people that are creating mayhem, trigger pullers, shooters, murderers, armed robbery crews, all the rest of it. That's who we're after. And in the United States, it's a free society. It is not hard to obtain a firearm. If you're prohibited, you can't go into a gun store and buy one. There's like 50 other ways that you could get one. I mean, one of them is simple: conduct a burglary or a vehicle break-in, or all of the diversion of the legal commodity to the gray black market. I'm prohibited. I can buy a firearm easily. You could parachute me into any city, and within an hour, if I wanted a gun, I'm going to have one. Even easier if you parachute me into a suburban area. But that's a free society. And people have felt the need to put restrictions on our freedoms, and it never works out. It never stands the test of time. The Second Amendment has stood the test of time.
Right.
It's still there, and it's going to be there forever.
And listen, I am very much, I mean, listen, I think it's Sweden or Switzerland. I don't know if you know this, Eric, right? But every single household has a government-issued firearm that gets locked away, and then a government guy comes and checks it. It's still locked and counts your bullets. Just in case a lunatic gets into power and the people have to rise up, right? Which I think is fantastic, right? Because then everyone's armed, right? But then nobody can just run about if they open their wee government-issued thingamabob, right? And I think that's a good way. I mean, I'm all for people having gun ownership over here. I don't know if I want to be part of the first generation, like maybe like come jump in on that like 20, 30 years down the line. But I think we should be able to at least arm ourselves to a non-lethal stature in this country, whether it's pepper balls, pepper spray, tasers, or the 50 caliber rubber bullets that fire out with the shotgun looking air press things. All of these, I think, put us on a level playing field with a 14-year-old who's got a machete and is coming at you on a scooter. So things need to be addressed. But Eric, listen, I have got a massive stress that has just arrived on my desk, right? There's a man in a van heading towards me with a tiny polar bear of a puppy right now. And apparently he's going to be here very, very soon. And now I'm freaking out. So if anyone's got any more questions, get them in for Eric and stay tuned, because I'll be live later on showing off the new boy. But Eric, what would you say to the people, right, that they can do for their neighborhoods, right? I mean, a lot of people don't like to feel like they're snitching, but community seems to have fallen at the wayside. And I think people need to start there, right?
It's simple. The golden rule. I treat others the way I want to be treated.
Yeah.
And the sense of community where I am, every neighbor looks out for everybody else. And it's a way of life that goes all the way back to the country's foundings and even before. If you decide, society will tolerate everything that it chooses to tolerate. And on the other side of the coin, there's a list of things that we're not going to tolerate. And that's a no-go with the community, the neighborhood. There's no shortage of storytellers in even the worst areas, the most violent areas. We are consistently able to develop sources of information, people that are going to tell us, hey, here's the guy that just did the shooting. And here's where the gun is, and here's why it happened. We consistently are able to get that information, and it matters not the economics of the neighborhood. It's sometimes a little bit harder in these gang infested areas, but we're still going to get it because we know how to talk to people, and we know how to do what we do, what society expects us to do. It is so the neighborhoods, we put ourselves in front of religious groups. Like anytime a church wanted any member of law enforcement, hey, could you speak to the congregation this Sunday? We'll jump at that opportunity. Could you come and speak before this community group? I've done that countless times. And I've also just proactively gone and where I knew there was a problem going on, and just start talking to people. You're going to find people that will help you. But more importantly, and I could take you to the worst neighborhoods in Kansas City, when you get older residents, and when I say older, I mean like 50, 60 years mm-hmm. old plus, they will straighten out the youngsters. And it used to be any parent could straighten somebody out. And it was expected. And if you went and complained to your dad, hey, Mr. So-and-so just yelled at me for doing this. Oh, really? Well, he might have just yelled at you. You're going to get you know,
right?
you're going to get a few whacks now.
Yeah, it was like that, and it's not like that now. Okay, I mean, parents are whipping each other's asses more often than not now. And
it's a breakdown of values, standards, and those things are what creates the culture of an organization, a neighborhood, anything, a school, the culture. What are good people willing to tolerate and not tolerate? And you really should be willing to tolerate nothing that's going to hurt people, that's bad for the community, any kind of narcotics things going on or worse. I think the fabric has always been there. It's always going to be there, but there is that force field to get through of getting, I'll put it to you this way, Ron, this will sum it up for you.
That's right.
I used to tell people that would say, why aren't you guys doing something about this? Mm-hmm. And I had a standard answer sometimes. I would be like, I can address that problem, but what I can't address is five generations of bad parenting. Like that damage over five generations, I'm not going to overcome that. I'll address this act, this problem, this murder, this shooting, but the way that these gangsters were brought up, the lack of a father figure, a good father figure, you got grandparents raising grandchildren because mom and dad are either dead, drug addicts, or in jail. What chance does that kid have? That's tough.
100%.
So I can't correct five generations of bad parenting, bad decisions, drug use, drinking, all the rest of it. But we do like to get in front of young people, like sixth grade and below, and give them some values and goals. I've sat in front of how many groups of at-risk youth? And I would say, listen, I don't make enough to live well, but I make enough to eat well. And by the way, if you get a good job and you're a disciplined investor and you can save money, you'll have that opportunity. And I would say to all of them, I would say, at the end of 35 years of living through the career, through simple, disciplined investing, I have over $1 million. And most of my friends are doing better than that. You can do that. You can do better than that. And that's on a government, salary
job. Yeah. Do you know, it's crazy, right? They released some maths that if you were working at the start of the 90s and spent the 90s putting 5 to 10% of your salary aside, you would be a multimillionaire by now, just through how money grows in the bank. It's kind of ridiculous, Eric, I'm not going to lie. But look, Eric, I would love to sit here and talk all night, but there is literally a tiny polar bear heading towards this house, and I need to do some things.
All right, we're gonna have to get into the story of the last shooting I was in and some funny little anecdotes of home invaders down on the Mexican border. Yeah.
Oh, we'll be back. Don't you worry. Don't you back? We will definitely be back. It might shift over to a Sunday, Eric, if you're available on Sundays.
Sunday, Monday, Friday.
Buffle.
Make the call, brother.
Buffle. Yeah. All right, brother. I look forward to it. Thank you, everybody at home. Stay tuned. I will be live later on. I feel sick with anxiety right now, but I'm so excited. Well, look, Eric, thank you so much. Thank you, everybody. Thank you to the More Things Edward channel. We'll see you all soon. Take care.
Peace. Thank you.
Oh, man.